Our next case this afternoon is number 242174, Intellectual Pixels Limited versus Sony Interactive Entertainment. Okay, Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Douglas Wilson on behalf of Appellant Intellectual Pixels Limited. This case is back for a second time on appeal because the Board violated the mandate rule. On remand, the Board completely reversed itself and overturned fact findings that were not challenged in the prior appeal, and this Court did not overturn. And indeed, one of those fact findings this Court even acknowledged. That violated this Court's mandate. And even if you ignore the mandate rule issues, Wiltshire never discloses compressing any image, such that the Board's decision was not supported by substantial evidence.
Can I ask you a question about the mandate rule?
Sure.
You know, in the cases that you cite, like Latrum and other cases, they really are dealing with a scenario where a party is arguing that under the mandate rule, a new legal issue can't be raised, as opposed to a subsidiary factual issue that relates to a factual question that underlies an issue, like what you have here. And it seems to me there's an important distinction between those when it comes to the mandate rule. What is your view on that?
I don't think there's any distinction at all under the mandate rule. And the case that I would cite to Your Honor is Bit Management versus United States. It's a Court of Federal Claims decision in which the case was vacated and remanded, sent back to the Court of Federal Claims for a determination of damages. When it came back up on the second appeal, this court said the Court of Federal Claims properly acknowledged that in considering damages, it was bound by its prior fact findings relating to damages, and it listed those off in the opinion. And so when those were challenged, this court said the Court of Federal Claims was in fact bound by those prior findings. Despite the vacate and remand on damages specifically, those fact findings were binding.
What about the breadth of our remand? I mean, if you look at the last paragraph of our opinion, we say that we disagree with the fact-finding that is central to the case, and we send the case back for further proceedings consistent with our decision. If our fact-finding on one limitation would lead the Board to realize that it also had to change its view on another limitation, why isn't that within the scope of the mandate?
Because, Your Honor, that, in fact, is specifically precluded by the mandate rule. So, in for example, let's talk about Bit Management for a second. Bit Management involved a...
Can we talk about this case a little bit more? Just because I'm confused. Why would we remand it if everyone could see that in the first time around the Board already decided that Sony failed to show compressing, and that would be a dispositive failure. If the Board had done that, I don't know why there even would have been a first appeal, but much less, why would there be a remand? This case would have been over.
Because the Board didn't take it that far. The Board did not decide that Sony had failed to show the compressing limitation. It didn't decide the compressing limitation. It didn't address that limitation specifically.
So then there was nothing to be appealed with respect to compressing the first time around.
I disagree, Your Honor. There were clear, explicit fact findings relating to the compressing limitation.
You can appeal fact findings that have no consequence to the judgment?
You can argue that substantial evidence did not support them that they should be overturned.
Really? What case says you can appeal fact findings that have no effect on the judgment?
So what this court's case law says is that you must raise every issue you can.
No, you're not answering my question. If there's a stray fact finding in an opinion, how can that be appealed if it has no effect on the judgment?
So if the party wanted to challenge that finding, so there's a few ways this can be done, right? If they are the appellant, when they come up, they can challenge everything that they think is unsupported by substantial evidence.
No, but you're not answering my question. There's a fact finding that has no effect on the judgment. How can you appeal it?
You simply raise it and say this is a finding that's unsupported by substantial evidence.
We don't review opinions, we review judgments. And if something doesn't have an effect on the judgment that's being appealed, you can't appeal it. If they tried to raise that the first time around, we would have said, that's not before us. That's not an issue. We're here dealing with the generating limitation. That's the only ground.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I think they would have to raise it because the mandate rule requires that. If they let it go and it goes back, this is exactly the issue in bid management software. There's this host of fact findings that were pertinent to damages. The Court of Federal Claims didn't find damages in the first appeal. And this court said, you messed up, we're going to vacate and remand for a finding on damages, but you are nevertheless bound by all those fact findings that are pertinent to damages. I mean, they had to raise it in the first appeal or it was waived.
Okay. What case, aside from bid management, says that you can appeal a fact finding which has no effect on the judgment?
So, I don't have a case site to give you, but I think there are many. I think this is straightforwardly a part of the mandate rule. The cases say the purpose is efficiency, so that we don't end up in a second appeal, right? Let's resolve everything that needs to be resolved in the first appeal. It's incumbent upon the appellant to raise everything they intend to challenge in an opinion below in that first shot. And if they don't do it, it's waived.
My concern again goes back to whether you're confusing issues with like individual findings underlying an issue. You might have to raise every issue that has been decided by the court below, but you don't have to raise fact findings that aren't going to have an impact on the judgment or change in outcome of an issue in the case.
So,
I mean, yeah.
Let me read to you.
Do you have another case?
No, this is bid management software.
So suppose for a second that you're right, that they had to raise their challenge to this fact-finding that had no impact on the judgment. How do you explain what we did in this case in saying the sole issue on appeal is generating and then remanding? Why would we have said the sole issue on appeal is generating, and why would we have bothered to remand? You could have, and plus, why didn't you point out, because I don't think you did, in the first case, Your Honors, we're kind of wasting our time here because there's an unappealed, essentially dispositive fact-finding with respect that'll preclude them from ever showing compressing.
So we actually couldn't. We number one, we did raise that issue. In our brief, we said the first finding that the Wilshire does not disclose the content or origin of that compressed MPEG file, we did actually raise that and say that it was supported by substantial evidence in our opposition brief. Sony said nothing in its reply brief. So we did, in fact, raise that. But let me also clarify. We actually couldn't raise it in the context of saying this is an alternate basis to affirm because the board...
It wasn't part of the judgment.
The board did
not... It wasn't
not.
Part of the judgment. That's why you couldn't raise it, right?
We couldn't raise it because it was, in fact, part of the judgment, but there was no judgment on the compressing limitation. So we couldn't raise that as an alternate basis to affirm. This court only reviews board decisions for basis...
Same reason they couldn't raise it. It's not part of the judgment.
But I disagree, Your Honor. I mean, let me read to you from Bit Management. It says... Indeed, many of the findings on which the Court of Federal Claims based its damages award are not and cannot be challenged. They were findings originally made in connection with the first trial and were before us, but not disturbed by us in Bit 2. Hence, as the trial court recognized, these findings cannot be challenged at this stage.
But it's hard for me to remember. I think you have the exact same panel that was on Bit Management, but it's some time ago. Didn't those findings have something to do with the underlying judgment?
So the underlying judgment was that and I can take you to the original case, actually. The underlying judgment in Bit Management 1 was that there was no liability because the Navy, in fact, had a license, right, an implied license. This court said, well, yes, they had an implied license, but it turns out they breached that implied license, so they lost their, they lose on the copyright claim. So it sent it back for a determination of copyright damages. So there were findings that were made in the original case that were pertinent to damages, but there were no damages assessed because it was an implied, the Court of Federal Claims found an implied license.
My question for you is, what case stands for the proposition that an appellant has a right to appeal with respect to fact findings, assuming they're fact findings, that have nothing to do with the judgment? You say Bit Management is not support for that.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. Okay. Precedential decision from this court. So I see that I'm into my rebuttal time, but let me make a few quick points. Even pushing aside the mandate rule issues, the decision here is not supported by substantial evidence. Sony relies on only two passages in Wiltshire for disclosure of the compressing new images limitation. The first is that compressed MPEG file. And the board's finding originally was that the content or origin of that compressed MPEG file, or Wiltshire does not disclose the content or origin of that compressed MPEG file. If that finding is applicable, then clearly they don't get, then clearly the board's decision must be reversed. But there are three things mentioned in that sentence.
Wiltshire talks about compression, right?
Oh, for sure it does, Your Honor. It says, in fact, the image may...
It talks about MPEG, too, right?
It does, Your Honor. It says the image may include any type of graphical information, including a bitmap, a JPEG file, a TIFF file, or even an encoded audio-video stream, such as a compressed video MPEG stream. Our expert, Dr. Hart, explained that the JPEG file, the TIFF file, and the encoded compressed video MPEG stream are all pre-existing on the server, and a person of ordinary skill in the art would understand that. That testimony is unrebutted. It was unrebutted before the board. The only other passage they have to rely on is the passage that states the bandwidth requirement can be further reduced using data compression techniques. It says nothing about what is compressed or when. There is no evidence in Wiltshire of active compression of any image, much less a newly generated image. And for those reasons, we think the board's decision should be reversed. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Okay. Mr. Downs?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. It's Jim Dowd on behalf of the appellant, Sony. May it please the court. The board did not reach the compressing limitation in its first decision. And so that limitation could not have been appealed to this court, and no findings related to that could be appealed to this court in the first round. The board's decision was based solely upon the generating limitation. Sony appealed that judgment, specifically challenged the findings upon which it was based, and this court reversed and vacated the board's findings.
What is your best cite for saying that the board's first decision never addressed compression? Looking at the analysis in the board's opinion?
I think it would just be the board's opinion itself. If you go through it, it says we're addressing the generating limitation in the portions that my colleague cites at A26 and A27, as well as A30. Those are all within the context of the generating limitation. There's never any discussion of the compressing limitation. And in fact, the panel last time, picking up on Judge Stark's point, the panel last time asked, let's say we find with you on generating, can we just reverse and that's the end? And we had to say, no, you have to remand because compressing wasn't reached. And to me, that was the moment at which my colleague should have said, well, that would be a futile act because you didn't appeal that issue. But the point is, we actually could not have appealed that issue because there was no decision on compressing.
There was no decision, but I think at least in passing, there was this statement, Wilshire's disclosure is completely silent as to the content or origin of the compressed video MPEG stream. Why shouldn't I view that as a finding of fact that at least has some impact on the compressing analysis and that the board should have treated itself as bound by?
Because that specific, those two statements, that's actually the second statement that counsel raises. The first one's at A26 and 27. They are a little interrelated, so I want to answer your question directly and then show the interrelationship. That specific opinion was challenged and was reversed by this court, and that's at A43. The first opinion, which is at A26 and 27, and why they're related, was the statement, but Wilshire does not teach that using the operation disclosed in Figure 2 with Doom, and we find nothing in Wilshire to suggest that a person of ordinary skill in the art would have understood Wilshire's system could possibly have supported that game in the manner proposed
by the petition. Well, we set aside that. We specifically reversed that.
That's my point, Your Honor. That is exactly what was reversed. And they're saying that that was undisturbed and therefore part of the mandate.
No, their argument has to rest on the other supposed finding.
And the other supposed finding was, having said Doom can't be part of Figure 2, we're now going to look at the casino game embodiments, and that gets us to 830. And there, what the board had said in the original opinion was, citing Dr. Hart's testimony, about pre-encoded files. They found that persuasive that these were pre-encoded, and therefore there were only pre-existing images, not necessarily generated in real time. And then there's what my co-counsel cites. We therefore, based on the pre-existing testimony, agree with patent owner that Wilshire's disclosure is silent as to the content or origin. That too was specifically challenged and specifically rejected. That's at A43. And I would take your honors to, A42. The discussion there first says, Wilshire's disclosure generates a new image contrary to the board's conclusion. That wipes out that finding. You then go on to describe Dr. Hart's testimony about pre-existing images, pre-existing files, and say the board's conclusion based on Dr. Hart's testimony that Wilshire does not disclose generating a new image are incorrect.
So that your view must be that all of those statements were in aid of the generating conclusion and therefore were subject of your appeal and we reversed them and so the board had to go with what we said about them. Is that correct?
That is exactly correct.
And
that's not right about the statement we were just talking about. That was in the context of the compression limitation. The board said something about the compression limitation. But I think that what the board was saying was the same thing it was saying about the generating limitation, that you have to have a new image, and Wilshire doesn't disclose a new image.
Respectfully, Your Honor, they accept that compressing is disclosed in Wilshire. What they say is, Wilshire's silent as to the content and origin of the compressed MPEG file.
Yeah, but it's in the context of compression. That doesn't have to do with generating. We weren't addressing that particular finding because that particular finding had nothing to do with what we were reviewing.
Your Honors, we're definitely reviewing generating. This statement was made in the context of the generating discussion, and to the extent that...
I don't read it that way. That doesn't make any difference.
Okay. Fair enough, Your Honor. I think... Council focused a lot on bit management. I think they are overreading what happened there. As I understand that case, there was actually a decision that on remand, these facts were found. They were not challenged in the second appeal, therefore there wasn't a mandate issue raised. And the panel observed, and they couldn't have challenged them because they weren't challenged in the first instance. That respectfully is dicta. I think that the closer case here is actually the integrated technologies case that we cite, where there was a finding in the first round with respect to whether there had been misconduct at trial. That was not appealed. The case was reversed, the findings were vacated, and then what the court said in the second round was the court on remand had to consider that anew, and the defendant was allowed to challenge the fact-finding with respect to this misconduct because those findings have been vacated as a part of reversing the prior judgment. That, I think, is pretty consistent.
When you stood up initially, you said something to the effect of we could not have appealed anything related to compressing because it was not part of the judgment and therefore couldn't have been part of your mandate. Is integrated technologies what you would cite for that proposition? If not, what would you cite for that proposition?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And I don't have a specific case in mind, but my recollection is consistent, I think, with Judge Dyke's articulation, which is you appeal judgments, not the subsidiary findings. Here, what we did do is we appealed the decision.
No, it's not subsidiary findings to the judgment. This finding has nothing to do with the judgment. That's why it's not appealable.
Fair enough, Your Honor. I didn't mean to gloss that. I just meant to agree that I don't think it was appealable. What was appealable was the generating issue, and we did challenge the facts upon which generating was based, and therefore, I think if you walk through, we did this just because I wanted to be sure about it. We literally just walked through and lined up. If you look at the statement that IPL raises at A27, that's challenged in our brief repeatedly, A3491, A3531, I could go on. And then at A43, this court reversed on that issue, found it to be error. A30, the statement there was the one about the casino embodiments from the figures 4A through 9D, challenged specifically at A3531, A3541, and then in this court's decision at A42, the board's conclusion based on Dr. Hart's testimony was incorrect. So I think we did challenge what we could challenge. It was reversed. It was disturbed. Those findings specifically were disturbed, and therefore the mandate rule required the board to do what it did. It did not prohibit the board from doing what it did. With that, I would switch briefly to substantial evidence, unless there are more questions on mandate.
One evidence question I have. What record evidence, if any, do we have that Doom required compression?
So I don't think that the Doom program required compression, Your Honor. I think compression is required by Wilshire's disclosure of what happens at step 230 of figure 2. And so if I can take Your Honor to that figure, it's at A1336. In that figure, there's a dashed line in the middle, and what's happening above the dashed line is at the server. What's happening below the dashed line is at the client. And then there's a loop back around through steps 260 and 270, showing that commands from the client can then be delivered to the server to affect the game operation. So after initializing the system at the top, at step 210, we have a game program that is executing on the server. And what this court found last time was that game program can be Doom, and it was undisputed that Doom generates images in real time in response to user commands, like let's walk up a set of steps or some other command. If Doom generates a new image, then we go to the next step, 220. Do we need to update the image? There the answer would be yes. And then step 230, send video stream to client. And it's that video stream that compresses. It's when you send that you compress. And that's at column 7, Your Honor. And it's expressed in Wilshire. I went too far. Wilshire says, in stage 230, an image is sent from the server host computer to 110 to client terminal computer 120. The image may include, and now I'm reading from lines 16, an encoded audio-video stream, such as a compressed video MPEG stream. And it goes on to specifically remind us, the image is generated by the game computer program.
You're reading at 1355, I assume?
1355, yes, Your Honor. And so the board found, and this is at A91, the board found that this disclosure of Wilshire disclosed the compressing limitation, and as you may appreciate, the compressing limitation describes the compressing and then the transmission of a compressed image. And then it goes on to recite how you can have compressed files and decompressing, and it found that part came from Saha. So the board looked at this disclosure, also looked at the disclosure at the bottom of column 7 where it describes using data compression techniques to reduce the bandwidth requirement. And that disclosure supports, more than amply supports, its findings with respect to Wilshire. I'd also note that there was some reference to Dr. Hart in counsel's presentation. Dr. Fuchs was our expert, and he laid out in some great detail exactly why all of this worked in the way that the board found. His testimony is at A1055 through 64. That's his opening declaration. A2324 through 2328 is his reply declaration. He explains exactly how a person of skill in the art would understand a video stream. That's what's referenced in box 230 to be a, and I'm quoting, sequence of frames or pictures where each frame is an image of a video sequence. He then goes on to explain how MPEG compressing is a well-known technique. And I would note here that the 109 patent concedes that it's a well-known standardized technique and has no greater disclosure about what MPEG compression is than Wilshire. Dr. Fuchs then explains Saha and its teaching of how MPEG includes compressed frames, decompression of those frames, how a person of skill would recognize that Wilshire's use of MPEG is for the intended purpose described by Saha. That's at A1063. And then in rebuttal to an argument that I think Dr. Hart had raised about whether this would be hard for a person of skill in the art to do this in real time, Dr. Fuchs opined no, that it was not, that it was well understood how to do that. And that's where he corroborated his testimony with the Lavoie reference, which describes this as, quote, straightforward, close quote. And that's at A1025 in his opening declaration and A2329 in his reply. So I would submit that it is that the board's decision is amply supported by the evidence. They had the ability to weigh the evidence, make an assessment between Dr. Hart and Dr. Fuchs, and they just credited Dr. Fuchs, and that was within their ability to do. So unless there are further questions with respect to either issue, I would respectfully request affirmance.
All right, thank you. Okay, Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Your Honors. Let me start by jumping back to the board's actual decision, and that's at Appendix 93. If you read through the board's actual analysis there, you will find none of what my colleague here just articulated. In fact, you will find nary a mention of compressing at all. If you read through their analysis, they don't go through the passages in Wilshire. They simply say, we find Dr. Fuchs' testimony persuasive and consistent with the court's guidance as to Wilshire's disclosure. They felt compelled.
I'm not sure I'm following you. At A91, turning now to the compressing aspect of this limitation, they seem in that paragraph to go through pretty much everything we just heard from counsel. What am I missing? There's stage 230, there's Wilshire figure 2, there's Dr. Fuchs is credible, there's Saha.
So if we go to A92, they there start to refute patent owner's argument. Wilshire does not disclose on-the-fly creation and compression of an MPEG stream, but instead could have used a pre-existing MPEG stream. And they point to Dr. Hart's testimony, and they talk about the findings, and then say, we're walking away from this finding based on what the Federal Circuit told us to do.
Right, but by the time they get there, they've already spent a whole paragraph saying, we are persuaded that petitioner has shown that Wilshire teaches compressing the updated image, etc. Why is that not substantial evidence?
Because, Your Honor, for the reasons I articulated earlier, which is Wilshire doesn't say or doesn't describe the creation of any image. Wilshire says, and the unrebutted expert testimony is, that the JPEG file, the TIFF file, and the compressed MPEG stream were all pre-existing on the server. That is unrebutted. And if I may add, going back to the mandate rule issue, I heard my colleague, the sole distinction he raised for bit management was that the passage in question was dicta. He didn't say the case didn't stand for what I articulated. Let me point out that right before the portion that I quoted, it says there's no clear error in any of the Court of Federal Claims findings, and we discern no abuse of discretion in its damages judgment. It was not dicta. The court was saying we're bound by those findings.
I mean, whether it's dictum or not, if you read it that way, it's inconsistent with about 100 other cases. But never mind.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank both counsel. The case is submitted.